Welcome to this series on metabolic health. Welcome to this latest installment from In the Know. This one's on metabolic health. You might have listened to the dozen or so I did on longevity or all the other tech and innovation stuff over the year. This one's really exciting. It's really topical. Ozempic's been all over the news. Buckle up, because we're going to get under the covers. Hey, it's Amal Sarva, and on this episode, I've got Dr. Waj Mehal at Yale, one of the leading, liver docs that's out there. I guess they're called hepatologists. And we're going to get under the covers on what is going on with metabolism, where carbohydrates and where do calories go inside the body? How do they get metabolized? Of course, the GLP-1s are a huge revolution, but how are they working? What are they interacting with? What makes the roadmap for what's coming next? What are the interesting molecules? And why is it that it's so hard to lose weight the old-fashioned way?
Your own inbox and your phone must be reflective of the world we live in at this moment. The boring corner of the world where you had to talk to people about NASH and fatty liver is all of a sudden a front and center topic around weight loss, obesity, and diabetes, all these things.
It's happening at the moment, and obviously a lot of that is driven through the advances of therapeutics. Of course, I mean, the diseases have been there obviously for a long time, but the therapeutics is really a huge change. And then the two are very strongly overlapped, the NASH and the weight management space. So I think clearly it's going to change how people approach these diseases therapeutically, but it might even make us look at them differently.
Let's just jump right into it. I mean, so like weight loss is the number one topic, I would say, in the realm of the public consciousness on health for the last year or year and a half. And this may increase, certainly as we discover knock-on effects. I mean, weight loss is probably the number one thing you recommend to someone that's showing disturbing signal around the health of their liver, for example. And it's not the only thing. There's plenty of other things that are just very directly correlated to obesity and weight. Everyone's talking about everything all of a sudden. I mean, even mental health and depression and all these things are related to weight.
Right. I mean, so it depends really, obviously, who we speak about. I mean, you know, the academic world doesn't change all that much because a new drug becomes available for obvious reasons. Whereas, you know, the broad readership or the lay world, of course, sort of gets turned on its head just because the drug comes along, which we've seen with the incretins, I think. It's difficult to overestimate the impact of the incretins. I think we're still in the very early stages.
The incretins are these GLP-1 agonists?
Exactly. So GLP-1, and then they're broadening out to GIP because there's more than one, and then they're basically multiple agonisms that are being packaged into single molecules, and there are now triple agonists available, GLP, GIP, and glucagon. GLP-1 is a hormone, and the drug essentially binds to the receptor for that hormone. Technically, it's a GLP-1 receptor agonist, because that's what the drug does, but people tend to say GLP-1 agonist in a loose sort of way, because obviously it's an agonist for the receptor and not for the hormone. That's been massively effective, at least, you know, the semaglutide version of that. And then there's dual agonist, which is also an agonist for a GIP receptor, is more efficacious and has fewer side effects. So that's the drug tirzepatide. This is a Lilly drug. Worthwhile knowing about that is that it's predominantly a GIP agonist with a little bit of GLP-1, but because it came after the GLP-1, people tend to think it's basically like semaglutide with a little bit of GIP added on to it, but it's not. It's basically a very different drug. It's basically a GIP receptor agonist with a little bit of GLP-1 added on to it, and that shows in its lack of side effect profiles. It has a much better side effect profile than semaglutide does. And then Lilly has at least one additional triple agonist, so it's the GLP-1, GIP, and then a glucagon agonist, receptor agonist actively thrown on top. But I'll just say GLP-1 agonist, I'll leave the receptor out, but you know what I mean. When these drugs are massively effective, and what's going to happen is that, you know, obviously the receptors for each of these pathways are in different tissues. So from the NASH perspective, you know, there are no GLP-1 receptors in the liver, at least on hepatocytes. Perhaps all of the effects from drugs like semaglutide on the liver are thought to be indirect, really, because of reduced calorie intake and mobilizing fat and such like.
So we're talking liver stuff, and for those that may not be on top of it, so NASH, I guess, is non-alcoholic liver disease, and then there's more serious versions, I guess, when you get to cirrhosis, and here you're talking about the cells in the liver, hepatocytes, and it's not a direct effect, but you're saying there is some direct effect on the hepatocyte.
Not from the GLP-1 agonist like semaglutide, but when you you bring in a third glucagon agonism, then there is definitely a direct effect. But, you know, I was using that as an example, but the principle really is that when you bring in dual and triple agonists, although they might be doing somewhat similar things, but since the receptors are in different cell types, each additional agonism doesn't just bring an increase in efficacy, it actually gives a different type of response. And we have to sort of look at what the predominant issue with the patient will be. So for example, I mean, obviously metabolic syndrome, some patients predominantly have an issue with hypertension, others predominantly have an issue with diabetes, others predominantly have an issue with NASH, and a lot of that is genetically driven. As these drugs come along with dual and triple agonism, I think what we'll find is that particular drugs will end up being particularly useful for subgroups of metabolic syndrome patients, and we're still having to sort of figure that out. If we step back a little bit more, one issue is that there are a lot of, I think, casual thinking involved in this space. So people, for example, will say obesity causes NASH, right? I mean, then you'll even see that in publications and such like. But really the fact of the matter is that, you know, overnutrition causes both obesity and NASH. So really it's not obesity causing NASH. We speak about obesity morning to night simply because it's the easiest thing to measure. I mean, it's so easy to measure somebody's weight, and we do it a lot. Obesity is not causing the NASH. Really, it's the overnutrition that's causing both of these things. And it becomes important, particularly when we have drugs that will disassociate the two. So, for example, there are other drugs which will basically decrease lipid synthesis in just the liver. Now, that person is still obese, but the liver can improve. You know, and there are various diseases where people have genetically cannot make adipose tissue. And these people obviously are not obese. These are super rare cases, but they do have really bad NASH. As we start to sort of have specific interventions, it becomes really important to sort of separate that out, that obesity is not causing the NASH. And also that has importance also for the patient, because a lot of people, unfortunately, you know, lay press or patients, you know, do latch on to the fact that their obesity is causing the disease.
And I guess the interaction of these different systems, I guess, is kind of where the action is. I mean, part of what I'm curious to take your view on is, where are we going from here? There's so many of these interesting drugs, and apparently they're hitting different targets. Well, there's a whole bunch more in the pipeline, and some of them have some common risks. Let's say the one that's most discussed is just muscle loss or muscle wasting. Yep. And so we'll have to address that, and that'll be a different target, I guess. And so we'll be creating yet another layer. We've got 1, 2, 3 active targets. We'll add a fourth or a fifth. Is that the right way to think about it?
I think that's the right way to think about it as a biologist and as a pharmacologist and as a clinician. Obviously, we hope that we're not entering a situation where, you know, somebody with metabolic syndrome is needing 2 drugs to treat or 3 drugs to treat various aspects of the metabolic syndrome, and then needing an additional 2 drugs to treat the consequences of treating, you know, say like muscle loss, for example.
Yes.
Right? I mean, hopefully we're not going in that direction, but I think what this is going to force us to do is to really work much harder at mapping the right multi-effective drug to the right patient, which hasn't happened yet. I mean, if we look at, say, semaglutide or even tirzepatide, the drug companies go through a particular sequence by which they test these drugs clinically, right? So initially diabetes, and then obesity, and then NASH. And those are all business reasons, because it's just easier to do certain trials and easier to get certain approvals. That may not necessarily be the best way to use each drug.
Let's zoom out for a second, if you don't mind, Dr. Mehal, and just get a little bit of where you're coming from in your story. You talk like the place that you were educated in the UK at Oxford, and then you landed up at Yale, I guess, about in the 90s. What is it, 30 years ago? Something like that, yeah. And have been working in this field. I mean, talk to me a little bit about how your interest brought you to this field, what some of your early work was about. Let's talk about liver and not just get obsessed with GLP-1s. Tell me the backstory that brought you to this topic.
So at medical school, I was interested and started a research project actually on hepatitis B infection, which is an infection of the liver. So I did various things, as happens whenever you go into a particular research project, you end up reading around it and become knowledgeable sort of in that space. So obviously I became knowledgeable about liver areas, and frankly, you know, just about everything is interesting if you just spend enough time looking at it. So it was interesting, and then when I moved for my postgraduate clinical training to Yale, I decided to clinically specialize in that area. So I became what's known as a gastroenterologist or hepatologist. So this would be early 2000s. But at that time, the big disease that was sort of front of hepatologists was hepatitis C infection. And between 2000 and sort of 2014, really 2014, very effective drugs became available for hepatitis C, which is great. So we can treat this easily and in 95% of patients with hepatitis C, so that's great. Hepatitis C, at least in the parts of the world that can afford these drugs, essentially has gone away. So that's one thing. And then, as we know, at the same time, beginning early 2000, sort of NASH was beginning to sort of raise its awareness from being essentially sort of a quirky little phenomena that nobody really paid much attention to. Obviously, you know, essentially it's a slow rolling epidemic. By slow rolling, I mean a multi-decade epidemic. And even now, I'm quite sure we haven't reached an equilibrium.
Well, just to get a sense for the scale of it, I believe like a antecedent to having full-blown NASH would be fatty liver?
So fatty liver is exactly as the term sounds. One, I think, important thing to bring out at this point is that having a lot of fat in the liver is not by itself pathological, because it's super important as to how we define pathology. If you see an individual, and really this defined at more than like 8% fat or 5%, but something like that. So if you see somebody with 20-25% fat in the liver, it's not automatically pathologic, because that's what the liver does. I mean, the liver is hardwired to pick up any extra nutrients and deposit, store it as fat. What's pathological is that a chronic state of overnutrition. I mean, obviously, through apart from the last 100 years, as a species, we go through periods of overnutrition, whatever that might be, and then we go through periods of partial starvation. But so what's really pathological is having this overnutrition for decades and decades and decades. So anybody who's overweight or who's obese, it's inevitable that they're going to have fat in the liver, because it's just one place where they store fat. So not surprisingly, this, you know, fatty liver disease is about 40% of the U.S. population, because that's roughly the distribution or the prevalence of obesity.
But I mean, that number is a show-stopping number.
These are big, huge numbers, huge numbers. I mean, about 7% of the population is NASH. I mean, we could have as much as, you know, between 0.5 and 1% of the population having advanced liver fibrosis.
Have we just not noticed it yet as a public health catastrophe? Is it just because everyone started gaining weight in the 80s and folks aren't old enough yet to manifest the late stage symptoms? Which, by the way, I think is what happened with Hep C, right? I mean, I believe that the contagion of Hep C started probably 20 years before the 2000s.
I think there's definitely a component of that. And the other aspect of it is, which is even more concerning, is that if you look at the upswing in NASH, when you break it down by sort of age, decades, the steepest rise is in sort of people in the 20 to 35 range. So I see two people who are 55 years old and 50 pounds overweight. It makes a difference as to whether one of them gained that weight from the age of 35 onwards, or if the other one has basically been obese since they were 10. So not surprisingly, individuals who had issues with obesity since childhood unfortunately present at a younger age and with a more severe presentation.
Which is to say that there is a cumulative effect of, I guess, the overnutrition slash obesity, which are correlated effect over that long duration, which is some kind of additional stress on the liver, or is it an inflammatory response?
Well, it's both. So a chronic storage of these lipids causes stress to hepatocytes, and they're designed to do it for 6 months or a year or something like that, but they're not designed to do it for decades. But that stress results in death of hepatocytes. And all tissue death results in inflammation, I mean, including whether we stub our toe or what have you. Any sort of tissue death results in inflammation. So then you start with a sort of positive or a vicious cycle.
If you were to relieve your hepatocytes every 6 months with a lot of weight loss and then load them back up again, that would at least be better.
That's the way it used to be. At harvest time or whatever, people would just... We've got to remember that, obviously, 10,000 years is a long time, but not evolutionary. There was no storage for calories. There was just nothing available.
No refrigerator, so you had to eat it.
No refrigerator. Most people didn't do salting. There was just or smoking. I mean, a little bit of that, but it's not like the whole population was salting or smoking your food. So, you know, you either stored it in you or it was gone.
So, I mean, one of the great dangerous things in biology is we have these kind of naive stories about how we used to live. That leads us to have some present theories. But you think that's more or less a well-validated way of thinking about the body. It's like feast, famine, hunter-gatherer, farming, all these things. Our diet really has changed, and our rhythms really have changed, and we have not evolved fast to adjust.
Right, and I'm sure, obviously, the macronutrient aspect is obviously massively important and a whole separate thing as to what we're eating and what we're not eating. But, you know, broadly speaking, you know, all societies went through lean periods, and I'm not speaking about, you know, massive starvation. I'm just talking about, you know, perhaps 2 months of the year where you get 1,200 calories a day instead of 2,200.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you just go to bed a little bit hungry, that's all. And that's when, you know, if you've got a deficit of 200, 300 calories every day, which is very mild, I mean, that's not a huge famine, but your body has to find that from its own reserves.
Right, and we live in a time where you probably have 500 or 1,000 more calories than you need every single day without any thought.
Or at least a couple of hundred.
So yeah. And so the way we got on this is the coming tidal wave, potentially, of liver disease. I mean, with this huge iceberg under the water of a fatty liver, and you're talking about how sensitive it is to age and duration. And so if we have all these people in their 20s now with fatty liver and then a huge cohort that has NASH, it seems to me that in this coming decade or two, there will be an enormous manifestation of very serious liver disease.
Absolutely. And obviously people have done medical models, et cetera, and that's the way that it appears to be. And that's sort of what we're seeing in clinic. In our program, we get 1,100, 1,200 new consultations a year. And unfortunately, we're frequently diagnosing cirrhosis, like on the first visit of somebody who's been young people 31, 32, 33 years old, who come for just, well, maybe there's something going on. And unfortunately, they have cirrhosis at the time when they come to us. So it's very concerning. There's no simple diagnostic test, which would obviously make monitoring or screening easier. People have obviously modeled the value of screening in NASH. And up till now, because there are no very specific and very effective therapies, in general, obviously, screening ends up becoming at some point a financially viable proposition.
If you could intervene, yeah. And so I was going to ask also about intervention. I mean, I assume you would suggest radical weight loss for somebody, depending on how far along the curve they are.
Right. So that's the good news. I mean, that's really sort of the ray of sunshine in the whole NASH space, is that when people lose weight, they mobilize fat differentially from different stores. So, and we sort of know that. So, you know, sort of like subcutaneous fat around the middle is sort of the last place that the fat is mobilized.
Frustratingly.
Right. However, on the flip side, the liver is one of the first places that fat is mobilized. So if somebody loses, say, 5% or 6% total body weight, which is not nothing, but it's not massive, the liver gets defatted by like 40%. When the body needs calories, the first place it goes to isn't adipose tissue or under the skin or where have you. It goes to the liver. So that's really the good news. And we have a lot of data that people, if they can achieve about 12% weight loss, that is sufficient to significantly help the liver.
I want to pause for a minute here and talk to you about Life Extension Ventures. It's the reason I'm doing this series for In the Know. Life Extension Ventures is a venture fund dedicated to working towards the longevity of people and planet. The future of humanity depends on our planet surviving. And its potential can really only be unlocked if we focus on some of the technologies, some of the breakthrough science that's making it possible for us to live longer and better lives. Life Extension Ventures is a venture fund focused on supporting visionary founders that are working towards longevity of people and planet. It's the future of humanity that they're working on, and we want to back them. I spent a lot of time as a science person, as an academic, as a student, and then I spent even more time becoming a company builder and venture investor. And with Life Extension Ventures, I'm bringing both of those things together with my partner, Iñaki Berenguer. He's got a similar story. And we're out there finding folks who want to build companies that can really make a difference for human life. We'll need this planet if we want to survive, and we'll need to focus on these breakthrough technologies if we really want to unlock human potential. So here we are doing it, and sharing with you in this episode is some of the breakthrough science that we've been learning about and trying to back.
Well, that's a very exciting result that I hadn't heard from other folks. I mean, I presume to you, you think about this all the time, but that would suggest it's very actionable.
Yes and no. It's not actionable by lifestyle, unfortunately. Mm. I mean, most lifestyle interventions really sort of average out at surprisingly low levels of 3 to 4%. And I think most people don't know that, which is what creates, unfortunately, a lot of this sort of misconception that it's impossible to lose weight, because people initiate lifestyle changes because, you know, the providers tell them to. The providers don't tell them what the typical effect of that will be. So people join gyms and they do various things and they think they're going to lose 30 pounds.
And it's virtually impossible to do that, and certainly sustainably to do that. But even to even get above 3 or 5% of loss is very difficult. Yeah.
That's what success looks like with lifestyle, about 3 or 4%. But there's a big gap between 3% and sort of the 12% that you need to really make the liver better. And the old weight loss drugs didn't quite reach there. By old, I mean drugs like Phentermine.
The famous and infamous Fen-Phen.
Yeah, well, this was the okay side of Fen-Phen. Yeah, so, and it's still used very widely. But it gets people to about 7%. Of course, significantly past that.
We'll come to this new world of weight loss drugs in a minute, but it is a very interesting current problem to be addressed, and I guess it connects right up to weight loss as the intervention that's relevant now. But I wanted to just maybe see if it's worth declaring victory against Hep C, as you just did very quickly. I mean, ribavirin, I think probably most people who've even heard of that drug heard that it was expensive 5, 6, 7 years ago when it first got approved for use in the US. And your view is it's out there, it works. And I presume some progress has been made on accessibility for that drug.
Yes, actually the new drugs are not ribavirin. Ribavirin was used a while ago, but there are several new drugs. Well, I mean, yes, I mean, accessible, you know, by U.S. standards, right? I mean, you know, that's the issue. I'm not actually sure how it's been rolled out in other parts of the world. Obviously, most Hep C, of course, is outside of the USA. But in the USA, most people who need it do have access to it. It's just because it's so effective, and it will be just such a bad idea not to treat somebody with hepatitis C because we have drugs that with 95% efficacy. But I really don't know about accessibility.
And just cost. We're going to turn to that in a minute when we talk about the obesity drugs. The cost and some of these treatment courses for Hep C 7 years ago were in the order of $100,000 or $200,000 for 6 doses.
I think from my recollection, they started on a high at about $70,000-$80,000. I think currently they're more in the sort of teens, $15,000-$16,000. So they definitely have come down, but $15,000 is no small change for...
Oh, no, absolutely. But I mean, yeah, for those of us from the sort of tech community and part of the excitement, actually, as biology starts accelerating and we start like hitting some of these things that we thought were intractable, is that with technology, we often get these kind of discontinuous leaps in cost. So something starts out expensive and it can end up just in the water, like an additive to your...
Big difference between the two situations of Hep C and what we're speaking about here is that there was a very clear understanding about the virology of hepatitis C. So as soon as the virus was identified in 1989, virologists knew what they needed to inhibit because it was a virus like many other viruses. That's not exactly the same with NASH. And that's why the NASH field has been struggling because people have been... Even now, there are over a dozen different sort of modalities of drugs that have been tried in NASH.
So what's the prospect? What is the mechanism? I mean, so you said overnutrition is the cause, but and you pointed to some of these interactive effects. What's the running hypothesis? How are we going to take it down?
I think if we can reduce overnutrition, that should take care of it. I mean, right? Hmm. But and obviously, that's where the incretins come into play. And then there are several other agents. I mean, in one way, we can divide them into two groups. Essentially, it's a normal liver in a toxic environment. So there are a couple of approaches. You know, one is to really improve the toxic environment, which is what the incretins are doing, and a few other drugs. And the other approach is to sort of say, well, we can't do much about the toxic environment. Let's just try and protect the liver in some way. So the first drug that was approved just last month is a thyroid receptor beta agonist. And that's fairly liver-specific because that's really where most of the beta receptor is. So it really doesn't do anything for the toxic environment. I mean, the patient's still consuming too many calories, too much sugar, et cetera, et cetera. But when you switch on the thyroid receptor beta, you increase metabolism. The hepatocyte starts to burn a lot of the stored sugars and fats.
There are many other ways to intervene, I guess, on reducing caloric intake and varieties of nutrition and diet. Would you care to map out a little bit how to think about eating? We already said that just the idea that with lifestyle you might have dramatic reduction in calories is not practical, or reduction in weight. Maybe we can talk about composition and pacing, things like fasting or maybe even bariatric surgery, unusual types of diet adjustments, things around, you know, the microbiome and biotics. And let's explore that territory a little bit.
Sure. I mean, that's obviously a very, very broad area. One concept would be that if there is a quote-unquote ideal or a particular liver diet, shall we say, people, it's a concept that's out there, right? I mean, is there an Alzheimer's diet? Is there a NASH diet? Is there a psoriasis diet, you know, et cetera, et cetera? That really doesn't seem to hold true. And usually with those sort of concepts, how people approach them is to more bring in particular items that would make that diet special. Or the liver diet, need to have more of artichokes or whatever. So that concept of a diet where you bring in particular nutrients doesn't really seem to hold true. A NASH diet is essentially a healthy diet. And that's a little bit disappointing because people would like to think that if they have this diet, then all of a sudden their NASH is going to get better, but that's actually not the case. That doesn't mean that one cannot make changes in the macronutrients that would be helpful. And obviously it depends on the diet. If, you know, I have some patients who would eat at McDonald's 5, 6, 7 times a week. And that's an obvious no. Then we all obviously have different levels of food items that are not particularly healthy for us in our diet. So on the whole, it's more a case of removing things rather than bringing things in.
Okay. Well, sugar, I guess.
It's the same thing that in generally we all understand.
Simple carbohydrates more broadly.
Exactly. Processed foods, you know, empty calories, carbohydrates, most of our excess calories are from carbohydrates.
And a processed food really is a bunch of empty calories. You don't mean some weird toxin because they processed your thing in a certain way.
I do mean just the empty calories. As you know, a lot of them come from corn-driven
sweeteners.
Sweeteners, and you can go down an aisle in a supermarket and look at 50 different products, but they're basically corn. The company's just taking corn and turning them into 50 different things. Now, you did touch upon something that was interesting, which is it theoretically possible that there is some sort of an agent that is worsening this situation? Because we can all imagine a situation where people who are obese have some extra fat in the liver, and that's it. You have extra fat in the under your skin, but you don't have inflammation of the skin. We don't have a dermatitis because you have extra fat. I mean, people who are obese actually have extra fat in their muscle cells, including their cardiac muscle cells, but they don't have a myocarditis. So this is something particular about the liver where, yes, you have extra fat, but you also have inflammation. So is there theoretically room for an agent that's in the environment that is actually making the injury or the inflammation? And there's absolutely room for that. I mean, there are no excellent candidates and such like, and, you know, having extra fat may just be a prerequisite.
What other things would you delete or edit? I met a team recently from Stanford that was working on amino acid exclusion diets. You know, there's 11 or 9 essential amino acids, but there's 21 of them in total, and your body synthesizes some of the ones that you don't need. If you're just down at the kind of cellular biology level, you can have a diet that didn't have all of them, and you'd be fine, but maybe your tumor wouldn't be fine. Your tumor is not quite as sophisticated and not so well-balanced, and so if you hunt around and you kind of exclude them one by one, you might discover that a very specific diet might be starving the tumor of the thing it needed.
With tumor biology, of course, what people have the weakness that they've gone for is that it's rapidly dividing. Whether you hit it with radiation and has high sensitivity or hit it with toxins, that's sort of always thought to be the Achilles heel of tumors.
I guess it's a slower moving target in the situation with liver, and there's not any other obvious candidates for things to exclude, I guess, because the liver basically just turns sugar into fat and stores it.
Well, you have to turn sugar into glycogen mostly, or more fat and free fatty acids. But you know, in general, I mean, as you know, just what people would consider as a healthy diet, which for most people actually requires removing items.
What about just removing everything? So maybe we can explore fasting. So 12 hours, 18 hours, 36 hours, 48 hours, doing it once a week, once a month, once a quarter, autophagy. Let us explore a bit perhaps fasting and its possibilities and consequences in
the liver. No, absolutely. I mean, I do believe that fasting, and obviously, as you just mentioned, the many different specifics as to how to fast. But in general, fasting, I think, is incredibly helpful. And again, you know, it speaks to the fact that, you know, we're designed for that. I mean, most people don't realize, but we spoke about having low calories, lacking, say, 200 calories a day or something like that. But if someone is in normal nutrient status, and we would all be hungry if we didn't eat for dinner or lunch or whatever, but if we didn't eat for 4 days, we'd all be fine.
That's actually true. I have tried it, and it is pretty amazing. I mean, the first time you try to go for 24 hours, it's a bit irritating. And there are some things that feel like blood sugar effects where your concentration and sort of the appeal of food or whatever. But by 36, 40 hours, it's kind of not on your mind.
Why is that? Because you're not, your tissues are not actually starving. Because after about 24 hours, your body has mobilized the adipose tissue reserves. So your body is actually making fuel. It's realized, oh, we've run out of sugar. There appears to be no calories coming in for whatever reason. So your body is making lots of ketones from adipose tissue. So as far as all of your organs are concerned, or your brain, your muscle, all the rest of it, they're kind of okay. They're like, okay, we don't have sugar, but now we have ketones, and we are very happy with ketones.
With metabolizing energy, so you were mentioning ketones, which I guess is, it's not the same as the glycogen, right?
It's a different molecule. I mean, ketones come from burning adipose triglycerides.
I guess the mechanism, is it a different speed? Is it processed differently by different cells? Does it move around differently? Are there cellular level explanations for what we might observe casually in the way we are metabolizing energy when we're powered off ketones? Because even your average person will consume all their blood sugar in minutes of exertion, I think, and move to glycogen, right? And that, maybe you've got 2 hours of that if you're not restoring it, if you're running a marathon or something.
Several hours. I mean, a marathon runners typically, I mean, they load up with carbs. One typical way of doing it is they usually run about at 20 miles, they run out of glycogen. And then somebody sort of described that as the wall.
Yeah, so call that 3 hours of running at 600 calories per hour. So something like 2,000 calories is kind of what you've got on hand in some carbohydrate-related format. So you're switching to ketones, and on the other end of that wall, presumably you find what feels like a stable source of energy, and it's ketones, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, the reason for that, of course, is that per gram, we can store a lot more energy in fat than we can in glycogen. So, you know, as a long-term strategy to most efficient way of storing energy, because again, the obvious cost of storing energy is just extra weight. If somebody who's 30 pounds of fat, and if they were to store that as glycogen, I mean, they'd be much, much heavier.
Right, just in total volume. So it feels different. Does it work differently? Is it mechanistically observed?
Yeah, very different molecules. I mean, ketones are actually very easy for tissues to use as an energy source. In fact, perhaps they might be the easiest energy source, because obviously, even if a cell takes in something what we consider simple as glucose, it's a pretty simple molecule. But I mean, we all know glycolysis. There are a whole bunch of steps needs to go through before that's actually available as energy. And ketones are one of the simplest forms of energy.
Well, what about consuming ketones?
I mean, I'm not an expert on this by any stretch, but people do propose for athletic performance, etc., to take in more simple food sources, shall we say, right? Ketones would be sort of one of the simplest food sources you can do. You can go online and buy this stuff. I have no experience in this, and I don't advocate it.
Well, and I haven't tried it either, and I know you can go online and buy them, but are they naturally occurring? I mean, can you get ketones just by eating animal fat?
No, because...
It's a very synthesized product by your body. Oh, and unstable.
I mean, I don't know how unstable they are, but essentially you can think of them as currency. You know, they're cash. Mm-hmm. They're not reserved. And so there are various biochemistry reasons why you can't just store huge amounts of ketones. So they're rapidly produced and rapidly used, basically.
That's a very interesting one. And we've been exploring different forms of like nutrition and diet and eating or not eating and different sorts of things as it relates to both liver and obesity generally. I wanted to come all the way back now to the GLP-1s, if you don't mind, just for a few minutes, and just sort of imagine what happens next, right? I mean, I think you were laying out quite clearly how people are stacking and hitting some different targets. Maybe some of the concerns of creating a sandwich of 50 different things in order to get the kind of moderated result you want. But I wonder what is next. I mean, having stumbled onto these in the late 90s, that it was just kind of discovered the way, I don't know, the very first vaccines or, you know, do we know more now? Can we find more now? Can we design them better now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one interesting thing in this whole area is that all the effects, most of the effects we're seeing of incretins are actually not biology, they're just pharmacology. And then, because the incretins have been known for as molecules for a long, long time. But in general, if you knock them out, say, in an animal model or something like that, not all that much happens.
To put it more plainly, we sort of knew they were around in digestion, and we thought, oh, well, let's boost those. But it turns out we're putting a ton in there, and it's not even replacing the use of glucose. I mean, it's not going to the liver, as you say. Wherever these GLP-1s are going and performing their function, they're doing something different than what we thought. So that's why you're saying a pharmacological effect.
Exactly. And the doses, for example, for Ozempic, you know, by the time someone's on a full dose, you're probably having an agonist effect that's several times higher physiological.
So it's gone and hit something else to cause this weight loss, which was not part of the bottoms-up theory of how it all ought to be working.
We just switched on the pathways more than they usually are switched on. You know, so essentially that's why it's a pharmacological effect, apparently not a physiological effect, which I think should give us some pause, because obviously we're taking a system that's clearly physiological, and we're driving it very hard at five or six times physiological levels, potentially for years. So at a theoretical level, I mean, fortunately, clinical trials haven't shown any major issues with that, but you can see why an issue with that. And it's not like somebody who's insulin resistant, which is a diabetic, and we're just giving them a functional amount of insulin.
And maybe the hopeful conclusion that I was looking to draw from this is, oh, well, you know, we figured out that system. Now we can go figure out other adjacent systems. But rather, the way you're putting it is, we hardly figured anything out. We just started seeing a phenomenon, and we carefully studied it to make sure it was safe and had the size of effect, and then we engineered the molecule a bit better to make it last longer, and that's all we've done. We've just been canvassing the world of molecules just like we always have been.
Right. So I think the people who stumbled onto this, frankly, got lucky. But clearly, it's very effective and appears to be safe. You know, I don't want to be causing unnecessary fears.
Because it's been out there 15 years. There's people who've been using it, the most severe need users for the longest time. But
at this pharmacological level of, you know, semaglutide, what is it actually doing? Which receptors is it hitting? Mm-hmm. Is it hitting now receptors that normally are not hit by endogenous GLP-1? We don't have an answer. So in fact, the basic scientists are now playing catch-up. Frankly, if this didn't have this weight loss effect, no basic scientist would want to understand what would happen to this system if you pushed it at 6 times?
Well, I mean, as they had ignored it for quite some time. So, okay, fine. As a speaking like the clinician that you are in part, you are a killjoy on our total understanding of science and biology. But perhaps there are some themes where you think there is some early promise. You know, it's like, this seems intriguing. We really, we should keep an eye on here. Because folks in the field, like yourself, are not surprised at their current efficacy. Maybe you were surprised 7 or 12 years ago when you saw some paper that it was seeming to work. Many of us are just hearing about it lately. Well, there may be things that surprised you in this last few years in this kind of stew of issues. I'm curious, like, where should people be hunting if people are? And has anything caught your fancy lately?
The biggest surprise, and it's, it's a happy surprise, is just the clinical efficacy, right? I mean, you know, here we have an issue of weight loss, which has been intractable for decades. And now we have a slew of drugs. It's not just like one drug. I mean, you have like a dozen drugs.
I saw the number that there's something like 70 GLP-1 agonist-related compounds. I mean, there's a few that are there, but there's so many more in pipeline. And I presume some of these are being studied at Yale.
Yeah, I mean, so what's happening is that obviously many, many companies are making combinations. The dual agonist GLP-GIP or GLP-glucagon. Many, many companies are making their own versions of them. And it appears that basically medicinal chemists can make them relatively easily. So why not, right? So there are lots of these drugs are out there. The other thing is that because we don't understand their basic biology or even pharmacology, no one knows what the ideal drug is. You know, so if you make a GLP-1 glucagon agonist or GLP-1 GIP agonist, what should the relative potency be for each one? Should they be equally potent? Should one be much more potent? Tirzepatide is a much stronger GIP agonist than a GLP-1 agonist, but is that the best thing to do? A lot of it is guesswork at the moment. A lot of it may actually be driven by trying to minimize the pathway that's producing side effects.
We have many things to look forward to in this field, and I think you're pointing to some important directions here. I have to thank you for spending time talking with me about all this.
It was a
pleasure.
Mean,
there are few experts in the world who know more about all this, and it's really been a benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Braskin. Enjoyed speaking. Take care, Mo. Bye-bye.
What a cool conversation with Dr. Mehal. I hope you found it as interesting as I did, and make sure to check out the other episodes.